Good morning. We are back, Bostopian News with Evan George, to look at the two most recent Boston City Council meetings. One taking place on December 13th as a goodbye to outgoing city councilors, and then the first Boston City Council meeting of the year, January 1st, and the swearing-in ceremony that occurred just before it and now has been the talk of some controversy. Now, I originally already planned to discuss rituals and the rituals that are used within the Boston City Council well before this whole oath of office thing blew up. However, it does fit very nicely, so yes, I will address it. But before we welcome the new, we have to say goodbye to the old. So on that final meeting, on December 13th, Michael Flaherty, Frank Baker, Kendra Lauer, Ricardo Arroyo, they were all given gifts by Mayor Wu, and I am curious what those are. I'm going to DM people afterwards. I don't like reaching out during the weekend. And the four were all given an opportunity to make a farewell address, we'll call it, with by far Frank Baker taking it the most seriously. Now, I'm going to just play some snippets of those for you, and we'll go in the same exact order that they went in, starting with Michael Flaherty. And I'm really just going to play you a couple things that I just think have either an interesting anecdote about them personally or have some political relevancy. Because while these figures are all leaving the city council, they are definitely not leaving Boston political life. And so what outgoing words of wisdom does Michael Flaherty have for us all?
That other cities, we're the envy of so many other cities. And working those partnerships, working those relationships is what makes our city great. And I would suggest that we need to do a little bit more of that here on the council, working together, getting to know each other a little bit better, rolling up the sleeves, being willing to broker compromise. You don't always have to have a whole loaf. You can have a half a loaf. You can have a quarter of a loaf and still make sure that we're moving our city forward. So
just to quickly pause him right there. Another theme that I'm going to talk about today is about the concept of zero sum, because it is what was given in Rootsy's first speech as the new president of the Boston City Council. And Michael Flaherty kind of also got at that concept there about you just need to be willing to compromise. Like, don't ask for too much. Be happy with a little. And he also deleted his Twitter account once he was no longer on the council, so I couldn't find it. But it reminded me of, I think, shortly after the brick funding eventually went through and Michael Flaherty, you know, quote, tweeted the passage basically saying, see, this is what compromise looks like. And that means that for them, they are expecting city councilors to compromise on their own subjugation or on the subjugation of communities that they themselves represent. That to Michael Flaherty and to the white conservatives on the council, that is what compromise looks like. And he continues.
With that, I just want to thank you, obviously, Council President, for the trust that you've put in me and to the committee assignments that I've had, the friendship that we've had growing up in political households. Clearly, your dad, my dad served together in the legislature, so we would see each other up in the halls of State House, would see each other down the rink, would see each other down the ball fields. But the Flints and Flaherty's have become very close. You've been a big part of that. So I appreciate the work you do. We're not always handed sort of a great deck to deal with this last term. But I can tell you, I appreciate the work that you do. I appreciate the time you put in.
Two things of political relevancy there, and then we'll move on to Frank Baker. Just starting with that last comment of you were dealt a bad hand. And what he's talking about are the counselors that he had to preside over as president. That those were the bad cards that he got dealt. Which is a wild thing to say out the door for what is really this meeting and the one on the first are really like celebrations. Like they're very somber, or not necessarily somber, but everyone is happy. Like this is them all getting along at the peak. Everyone's cordial. Everyone's inviting. Everyone's, you know, smiling and hugging and shaking hands. And so, you know, just to really quickly have the comment of, hey, you know, you got a real bad hand with these people that you had to work with. Little out there. But the other thing that he mentions, and I think this is one of the only times that he has ever publicly gotten like a little emotional, because Frank Baker calls that out in his speech afterwards, is about, you know, growing up in a political family just like Ed did. And Frank Baker has an amazing quote on this. And it's something that I've commented ad nauseum on this program, that so many of these people are really just elected because of who their parents were or who their uncle was. And I'm going to play for you that clip from Frank right now. And another big difference in why I made the comment that Frank took this by far the most seriously is, I'm sure Michael Flaherty, it looks like he has some prepared words, speaking a little bit more emotional, a little bit more off the cuff. He's doing it from his designated seat in the chamber. And Frank Baker asked to speak from, you know, the president's chair, the podium, I forget what the term is. And, you know, Ricardo and Kendra follow suit in that, but Frank, you know, makes it a point to ask, can I do this? And so, Frank, what words of wisdom do you have for us all?
As a mentor said to me about my 12 years on the city council, you know, with talking and thinking about the 12 years, and in the first campaign that I had really molded me, really prepared me to be a city council that was gonna show up for the district. He said to me that I served with honor and distinction. That's pretty cool for someone to look at me and think that I have honor and I have distinction. After that first campaign, I had one conversation. It was with my congressman, Congressman Lynch. He said to me that a lot of times, especially coming from a neighborhood like mine, that you get elected your first time because of who your parents were and what your parents did.
Now, I have never heard a politician publicly say that. Like, maybe in passing, maybe I've heard many times, you know, referencing having a big family, referencing being part of a political family, but just to really blatantly make the statement that many times you just get elected because of who your parents were. And it's very, very refreshing to hear someone say that, especially someone like Frank Baker, who, what, like 30 seconds before that was, you know, getting teary-eyed about, you know, stating how he has honor and conviction. And, you know, as we go on in this episode and start talking about these rituals that they do, it gives us the sense of why politicians have this insanely inflated understanding of both themselves and the role that they play in our government that is just reinforced by all these crazy things that we just do and these rituals that kind of just, you know, put in the back of their mind that their own importance and power and just reinforce this God complex that they all have. But thank you, Frank, for just openly saying it. And before we leave him, he goes on to talk about why he ran for office in the first place. And if he doesn't mention it here, he did, of course, mention that he was fired from his job at the printing company. I think that was maybe his third sentence into the speech, because my God, that is his rosebud in life. Anyway, take it away.
So I wear this color so we can heal, and so I can honor my parents. The honor of being able to serve District 3 in the city of Boston, coming from where I came, I was a high school graduate, never went to college, was a printer, always worked on campaigns, but never saw myself as the person that was in front of you speaking to you, never saw myself doing this. But I saw a need. I thought my neighborhood was underserved. The police never showed up. The streets were dirty. We had the red line running through our neighborhoods. It's where a lot of the crime was happening. I didn't feel like people were listening to me, listening to our neighborhood. So I'm just overwhelmed with gratitude and thankfulness
that the people in Boston, that the people in District 3, that the people in Dorchester and the South End and Lower Roxbury had the faith in me. The 12th of 13 and the Baker's Dozen, they had the faith in me. I spoke for them. That's an amazing responsibility.
Now, I didn't realize Frank had that many siblings, and that is incredibly cute, the nickname A Baker's Dozen. And it also goes to just how unmovable he is or was as a political figure. If you have that many siblings, that many nephews and nieces and cousins and second cousins and uncles and so on and so on, and everyone that they know, you don't need to have a campaign. You just need to have a family barbecue, and you're good. That's the votes. But just that other element of why he ran, the idea that in his neighborhood, the police weren't showing up in, what, 2012? Or that crime was out of control at that time? I mean, I bet you he thinks that, 100%. I think he was more projecting about his childhood, probably. 1980s, absolutely, I believe that, if you look at crime statistics. But just never letting that go. Decades later, massive, massive drops in crime. But still, in his mind, we live in like a post-apocalyptic era, and his childhood was all like candy canes and rainbows. But okay, we will miss you, Frank. And he does hint at during his speech about what he's doing next. He mentions mentorship, and he mentions planting trees. So he definitely already has something lined up. I'll be very curious what he does, keeping an eye on Flaherty also. And I really only have one other clip from Kendra and Ricardo that I wanted to play, because neither one really had prepared remarks in the same way that, like, you know, Frank's giving us his magnum opus during the speech. And Kendra mostly just thanks people, so there's nothing really politically too relevant, though obviously this is a pro-Kendra podcast. And I just wanted to play for you one small thing about Ricardo that I'll expand on.
Every person who stood up here has had a good article written about him and a bad article written about him. And I can speak for myself. I don't get on the highs and I don't get on the lows. You know, if you overindulge in the adulation, then you have to overindulge in the jeering. And so I try to not indulge in either. But your family members read that and see that and feel that, and they carry the weight of that. And so I want to acknowledge Jennifer Calcano, who is my partner, but today was too difficult of a day for her to be here. And, you know, I want to acknowledge that it's been difficult for family as well to see someone that they love sort of have to go through and deal with certain things. I want to take a moment to acknowledge that I'm very grateful, incredibly grateful for folks on this council who have taken time at difficult parts of the last 2 to 4 years to check in, to say, hey, I saw this happening, care about you. Really appreciate that. I want to take a moment to show grace to those who took that opportunity to pile on or to push them further, and just acknowledge that, you know, you can have that duality on a body and still have civility and still have the ability to move work forward.
So I found that fascinating. I definitely found that something that I wanted you all to hear. You know, him talking about his fiance, like, not being able to be in the room just because of, I'm sure, like, the anger and rage that she feels. Him talking about what the negative press does in terms of, like, you know, your family reading it and how you navigate those waters. And what I'm really curious about is his future and what he's going to do next. Because if I had to put money on it, he will get reelected to something. Not in the next couple years, maybe, but if I put a line at, like, in the next 10 years, I would probably say he will be back in some capacity. And I think, you know, demonstrating him sitting next to Kevin Hayden at the Electives of Color holiday party and him being incredibly intelligent, I think he's going to do a public redemption tour. I think he's going to focus on building up goodwill within his community again. He'll probably find something in the legal world. I mean, just with all the ties of his family and his own experience, it's not going to be hard for him to get a job somewhere. And people love a comeback story. So I definitely don't think this is the last that we'll see of Ricardo in elected office. And with that, goodbye, Flaherty. Though he might, I don't know, a little bit worried this guy's going to be running for mayor in 2 years. We'll see. Goodbye, Frank. Goodbye, Ricardo. Goodbye, Kendra. And now we are not going to go in consecutive order. We're actually going to skip the ceremony for now and just jump right into that January 1st Boston City Council meeting. And it begins with Liz Breeden chairing over the city council, because with Ed Flynn's term as president being over, according to our city charter, it is basically whoever the oldest person is now the temporary chair, the temporary president, until we actually swear someone in. I just think that's kind of funny. And we're going to skip the invocation for a moment, though I'm going to go back and talk about that, because that is the first big, big ritual that I really want us to explore. We will now going to look at the little drama that emerged around the electing of our next Boston City Council president. Now, as people remember, it took 48 hours from the end of the general election for Ruthie Louis-Jean to come out and say that she has the votes to be president. There was some pushback as to her not even notifying other members of the Boston City Council before notifying the press about it. And now we have those nominations for president, and Gigi gives Ruthie the nomination. Again, this is a fait accompli. Everyone already knows the math. This has been out there for months at this point. But we had another nomination. Let's hear it.
I've been informed by the clerk that we do not need to second these. We don't need a second for the nominations. Are there any other nominations? No. Councillor Flynn?
And actually, just to quickly jump in, so Liz wasn't even expecting there to be another nomination. That is why that was like this long pause. Like, she's not even like looking around, because again, this is over. This is done. She's now just like reading from the pamphlet, reading from the agenda to like move this along. And someone has to inform her of, oh, I think Ed wants to say something. All right, but it continues.
Madam President, I would like to nominate City Councilor Julie Mejia for president.
Thank you, Councilor Flynn.
Yes, a last-minute nomination for Julia Mejia. Are we to believe that Ed Flynn thinks that truly it should be Julia leading the helm into the next session? Absolutely not. And now the people who are, if you're nominated, you have to either accept the nomination or decline it. Ruthie accepts it, and Julia, very, very intelligently, very, very articulately, with a lot of humor and a lot of grace, says that I am not accepting the nomination because she knows that this is just a political ploy to try to get the left members to fight amongst themselves, to try to put Julia and Ruthie in an antagonistic conflict with one another, and now that might affect chair seats, because who knows, maybe Tanya will start throwing a support with Julia, and they are just trying to do some last-minute division, which is what you do when you're in the minority. You try to break apart the majority. At least in this case, what the ideological lanes are in. And though Ed Flynn failed to create this division, the Boston Herald, of course, was not going to let this chance slide. And they have an insane headline. This was published on January 1st, Gayla Cawley, with the title, Boston Pot Shop Owner Played Part in City Council Vote for President. Now, they are, of course, talking about Tito Jackson. But the framing that we are going to refer to Tito Jackson as a simple Boston pot shop owner playing a hand in getting a Haitian woman, a woman of color, elected to be the city council president is such a disgusting and racist framing. Even though we have in some ways moved on beyond thinking of marijuana as, you know, like a jazz cigarette, clearly, the editors of the Boston Herald have not let that go. And yes, Tito Jackson does currently own a marijuana shop. But that is, of course, not his political relevancy. There are dozens and dozens of marijuana shops in Boston. That's not really why we all know who Tito Jackson is. And what this talks about is that Tito Jackson called Julia and asked her to step aside. And where is the Herald getting this evidence that Tito called and meddled in these affairs? Well, looks like it's from both Ed Flynn and, of course, Aaron Murphy. Just reading for you a little bit. Flynn and City Councilor Aaron Murphy, who had been considering seconding the nomination, told the Herald that Mejia appeared to have a change of heart after speaking with Jackson, who approached her just before the council meeting began. Quote, "I think it was inappropriate and disrespectful for former Council Tito Jackson to discourage Julia Mejia from running," Flynn told the Herald. And later on, we get a quote from Aaron Murphy. "It's unfortunate to me that we weren't able as a body to hear from the president the nominees before the votes," Murphy told the Herald, referring to their respective plans for the council and reasons for running. "There haven't been open conversations up to this point," Murphy added. "I definitely was looking forward to hearing from both sides." Now, this show has always contended that Rootsy really formed an alliance with the white conservatives during redistricting, and this is what locked her in to be the next city council president, even before the votes had her as the number one overall vote getter. However, I think during that episode, I also said, we're going to learn a lot by the committee seats. And I really, really hope that this quick attempt at division between Ed Flynn and Aaron Murphy, and then instantly running to the press because Julia didn't fall for what would have been a dumb political move on her behalf, I hope that starts to create division with the white conservatives and Rootsy, and that Rootsy holds this against them. That on the day that she is sworn in, which also, in a great story, it is also the anniversary of the Haitian Independence Day, which was the culmination of the true revolution of the 18th century, the one that actually was about principles like freedom and democracy. That was not the U.S. Revolution. That really wasn't even the French Revolution, that was the Haitian Revolution. Anyway, on that day that the Herald is running these like negative articles, and yeah, take some revenge, Rootsy. Let's do it. And also should note that it is also Julia Mejia's birthday, apparently on January 1st. So yeah, a lot of celebration. And I'm now going to play for you part of her speech, because now we return to the Michael Flaherty loaf thesis, which is actually pretty politically accurate, and how that conflicts or just follows that theme a little bit. And now, what is Rootsy's view on really politics, we'll call it? I promise I'll make this make sense after you hear it.
Makes a robust nightlife safe and possible, and makes getting to work safe and possible. I believe in all of us, and I believe in Boston. One thing to know about me is that I unequivocally reject any zero-sum mentality that suggests, thank you, Reverend, that suggests that for one group to succeed, another must lose.
Now, I'm going to address the concept of zero sum by the third definition of what she might be referring to in using that. Because in the simple first definition, she might simply, this is her first speech as the council president, of course she is going to give a speech that is framed around the thesis of working together, of compromise, of us all succeeding together as a city, right? Could just be as simple as that. There could also be a second definition, that who she is referring to are different ethnic, racial, national social groupings that every city has, most certainly have it here in Boston, and saying, like, you know, for Black people to do well, that does not come at the expense of the Haitian or Dominican community, or for the Asian community of Boston to prosper, that doesn't need to come at the expense of the Latino or the white population. Okay, all that is true. However, the third definition, the one that is most commonly used in political circles, is one framed around material resources and trying to figure out, is this going to be a vote or a decision that literally, if we put money in coffer A, we are going to have less in coffer B? Or if we are going to fund this program, we now have less money to fund other programs? Because that is very, very much zero sum. We have a fixed budget, 4.3, let's call it 4.5 billion probably for next year. And we are going to have to make decisions of where do we put that money? Are we going to put that in programs that already have way too much funding? Are we going to put it at levels or in programs that we think have adequate funding? Or are we going to put that money in programs and services that we think are drastically underfunded? And sometimes those are actually objective measurements. We can look at some things using the economic law of diminishing returns and show, oh, look, if we put this dollar here, this agency already has so much funding, the police, that it's not going to make a difference because they've already maxed out. However, there are other programs, early childhood education, that all of the research shows us that for every additional dollar we put in this right now, the city is going to get back $5, $10 in returns. And so it just makes an objective economic sense. If we're trying to figure out where to put that dollar, you would put in early childhood education over something like the police. However, we don't always have neat little numbers like that. And it is also highly subjective of what needs more and what has enough. And that is definitionally a zero-sum game. And again, I don't know to what extent she really accepts that. And if I had to guess, looking at Rootsy's political ideology and the tree that she comes from, I kind of think that she doesn't view politics in the way that I just expressed. And she doesn't see things that are in dialectical opposition to one another as being so. Like, for example, my rent and my landlord is in direct dialectic conflict. That for every additional dollar my rent goes up, my landlord gains money, and I lose money. And if some miracle occurred and my rent decreased, for every dollar I don't spend on rent, I now have more and my landlord will have less. And there are many elements within running a city that are in direct conflict. And that is why politicians generally end up representing certain groups and certain interests as their constituency. Not just who's within their district when you're doing constituent services, but what lanes are you running in? What side of that are you pushing or pulling? And I don't necessarily know if that is how Rootsy understands politics. But that is most certainly something that maybe we'll be able to answer in her term as president. And now, finally, for a fun third segment, we've done our goodbyes, we just had our hellos, kind of, and now we get to talk about rituals. Because the Boston City Council, like all political bodies, have a lot of rituals behind it. And I don't just mean, or I'm not talking about like Robert's Rules of Order, like the actual like structure of how you run a meeting. I am talking about the things that occur before and after the meeting. And I really want to talk about the invocation. Because before just about every Boston City Council meeting, there is an invocation where I believe they do it on a rotation, where a certain city councilor gets to pick someone to do the invocation, and it is generally almost always someone of a religious background, because it is definitionally a prayer, or almost a prayer. I mean, just reading the most basic definitions of the term, the act of invoking something or someone for assistance or as an authority, the summoning of a deity, an incantation used to invoke a deity or the supernatural. These are things that we do before Boston City Council meetings. And I remember during Bush Jr.'s presidency, he took a lot of heat because before his meetings, they would have prayer. And a lot of people pointing to that as like this just weird evangelical takeover of the office of the president. But we do, and many municipalities do this, and it has always struck me somewhere between weird and uncomfortable to this is not healthy. And our politicians being exposed to this before every meeting is why they have this grandstanding, this holier than thou, and also this cognitive dissonance sometimes between why they're really voting on something and why they think they are. Because for the founding of not just Boston, but of this country, it was the actual belief of our political leaders that they sat atop of a hierarchy because God blessed them. That was something that they innately believed strongly, like unemphatically, in the same way that we believe in gravity today. That was a core belief that they had. that their privilege, their power, their wealth, them being able to write laws and to govern and to allocate the budget, they have that power because God granted it to them. And because of that, well, I must be a moral and just person because that is why God chose me, right? And therefore, it is that morality, that justice, that I'm going to make decisions selflessly, that transcend the boundaries of normal human behavior because I have that blessing of God within me. And of course, when you structure a government like that, and that's not how things work at all, it instantly divides into an unruly mess where sometimes the elites can't all work together because it's in their mutual interest to do so, but other times different elites might have different priorities than other elites. And you might have the formation of political parties, something that our entire government was not framed around and in fact depended on it not happening to function. And while centuries later we have moved beyond our conceptions of God and the way that they felt strongly in that 18th century, we still carry some of these traditions and rituals today for our political leaders. And I'm going to play from you the invocation that started that January 1st meeting. And it is given by Reverend Laura Everett, and I have absolutely nothing against this person. I am sure they are highly intelligent and a fantastic person, maybe even share my same political values. I am not knocking her. I am not knocking the scripture to which she is reading or making an overall statement on religion, though it might just be helpful for people to know that I was raised Catholic, I'm confirmed, I'm in the club, I grew up going to church, it's nothing that's foreign to me, and I also still do some rituals, especially around like mourning and grief or showing respect that very much is mimic the rituals that I was taught as a Catholic. That stuff stays with you. They're mostly used in a lot of different circumstances, sometimes just how to move through a grieving process. But I want you to just listen to this invocation or parts of it that I'm going to play. And just you tell me, does this seem appropriate to lead off like a budget meeting or to just have a city council meeting? Do we need to do this now?
Dear friends, hear these words from the prophet Isaiah, the 43rd chapter, verses 15 through 21. I am the Lord, the Holy One, the creator of Israel, your king. Thus says the Lord, who makes a way in the sea, a path in mighty waters, brings out chariot and horse, army and warrior. They lie down, they cannot rise, they are extinguished, quenched like a wick. Do not remember the former things, or consider the things of old. I am about to do a new thing. Now it is springing forth. Do you not perceive it? I will make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. The wild animals will honor me, the jackals and the ostriches, for I give water in the wilderness, rivers in the desert, to give drink to my chosen people, the people who I formed for myself, so that they may declare my praise. Let us pray. Holy One, your people humble themselves to pause before so audacious a task as governance, to remember that we are not gods. We did not create the waters or the mountains, the hills or the desert. We did not create this building, this city, this earth upon which we stand. Oh God, your people humble themselves to pause before so audacious a task as governance, to remember that we are not gods, and to awe at the new thing about to begin.
Now that goes on for about another 2 or 3 minutes, but I'm sorry, can we all just take a breath and like relax a little bit and just vote on who's gonna chair the next session as president and, you know, let's move on with the day? And I mean, like, I think the substance of what she was saying is basically getting at that while the politicians have the power of gods, they are not gods. But I just don't think it is healthy that before these people sit down to do just, I mean, decisions that are made by like school administrators, board of directors, nonprofit boards, like you're just, you were elected to fill this role. Can you just vote on this stuff? Like, no one is confusing you with gods. And they start every session by basically asking God for humility, asking God for guidance. And if you want to do that on your own time, and that is how you process yourself and your way in the world, absolutely. I think faith is actually very important. But doing it publicly in these rituals and ceremonies, what I think it actually does is to create the opposite effect and to put in these people's minds that they are gods, and that we, the people, aren't the ones who have to check their power. It is their own innate goodness and blessing by divine right that will be the check on them. We're going to ask God to handle this, not the people, not the voters. We are just witnessing this communion between our betters and God in this little public ceremony. And now they're going to like vote on whether or not I can pay rent or not. And this ritual is followed by another that at least it makes a little bit more sense, though I still always find it bizarre. But they do the Pledge of Allegiance. And okay, it's a local government. You're still part of the United States. That makes sense. One thing that I always laugh at is that when they do the Pledge of Allegiance on the screen, if you ever watch like the YouTube footage like I do, they drape a massive translucent American flag that's like waving, and then you can kind of like see through it, so you can still see the original video, but you're just exposed to this massive flag like just punching you in the face. But okay, at least like, you know, it's part of government, so that does make sense. It makes a lot more sense than someone screaming, "We're not gods," before a meeting. And now finally we can get to the swearing-in ceremony, because that has another just really funny tradition to it. I'm going to try to play it to you, but the person's a little bit off mic. So I'm going to narrate what's happening. We're in the chambers. Someone from the back starts banging. Hear ye, hear ye, all rise. For our Honorable Mayor Michelle Wu. And the soon-to-be Boston City Council, that may have been the words. And triumphant music is playing. Round of applause. And a man wearing a top hat, carrying a scepter, is leading Michelle Wu, some city council staff, and the up-and-coming Boston City Councilors to the stage. And it's just filled with these, like, fun little rituals that we kind of just do. Like, you know, the announcement, the entering, like, the banging of the scepter. Like, why is there a scepter? Who is this person that's marching it? Why are we being asked to stand before them as they enter? And for some people, they would simply say, shut up, it's about respect. However, there is somewhat of a line difference between respect and performative acts of obedience. And sometimes they might look the same, but they certainly serve different functions, respect and obedience. And I think a lot of these things, these rituals, like even the simple act of demanding we all rise, is an act of obedience that our government is having us slowly perform over and over again. To go on a fun tangent, it's also kind of how I view the TSA in airports. It is almost beyond a question that they are ineffective at what their stated purpose is. But we still do them in these like weird little rituals of obedience, even though, again, they don't actually serve the essential function. And we don't really need to speculate too much on these sort of like political rituals. Like, we know at the time the debates they were having was about how do we instill importance and power into these positions? What titles do we grant them so that the people, the commoners, will know that these are their betters, that this is something, again, akin to a priest or a pope or a cardinal or a bishop. This is something above in a very literal sense. And we still just carry on these like weird rituals to this day. Now, this also has an invocation, of course, again, beginning with a prayer. And like we're asking God to kind of like help these counselors which, no, I'm sorry. We, the people, are the ones responsible for doing that. Again, let's keep God kind of out of this. Doesn't seem necessary or appropriate. And this is followed by a benediction, which is another prayer at the end. Again, I don't think I need to play them for you. I think you kind of understand my point on it, even if you disagree. I just always think these things are odd, and I think they serve a detrimental focus on, like, politics and people within political positions. You're not gods. No one thinks you are. No one's confused at this. Just pass the budget. Just do a vote. And to the ceremony itself, Michelle Wu speaks. I don't necessarily need to play that for you. One thing that she did is that she collected statements from the new counselor's family members. She did it for Susan also, because this is her first time being, you know, sworn in for a full term. So from her, she got words from her sister, from John Fitzgerald, his mom, Enrique, his wife, Henry, his father. And for Ben, it was kind of a collective with his two kids and wife. It was cute. I support it. But now, let's get to the ultimate ritual, the final one we're going to talk about for today, the Oath of Office. I'm going to play some of that for you here.
It is now my honor to administer the Oath of Office to the Boston City Council. Would you please rise and raise your right hand, councilors? Oh, sorry, just councilors. Sorry, my fault. Everyone else relax. New Year's Day. Okay, please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, state your name, do solemnly swear.
I, Anna Julie Jen, do solemnly swear.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance.
To the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
To the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
And will support the Constitution thereof.
And will support the Constitution thereof.
So help me God.
So help me God.
So it continues. You get the idea, right? You're kind of just standing there, kind of just mumbling in it. For some reason, you're giving it an invisible high five, even though, I mean, I understand, the ritual behind it. But back in the second row, and you really can't tell from the official footage, because she's kind of behind Henry Santana, who, actually, I think John Fitzgerald is the tallest. Henry, I think, might be the second tallest of our current city councilors. So you really can't even, like, see her mouth. But Councilor Tanya Fernandez Anderson did not verbally echo the words of the oath. And someone got a camera angle of it, apparently, and then this got promoted with the right-wing Libs of TikTok account, whose function appears to be to try to drive as many queer people to suicide as possible. I'll just read to you what the TikTok was. Meet Boston Councilor Tanya Fernandez Anderson, a radical activist and an immigrant from West Africa. During her swearing-in, she refused to repeat the oath and raise her hand. She hates this country and Constitution. Now, it goes on to say other things. But just from, you know, that framing, like, what do we think they're really mad about? This is obviously just another very dumb, racist attack to continue to fit the narrative that immigrants hate this country, particularly the ones of color, that they are disrespectful, they should be thanking us, and by us, they mean white people, for giving them this country of ours. And again, for ours, it's of the white people. And then we had a fun day or two to try to figure out, well, to actually correspond with this ritual, according to the Boston Charter, do you have to even do those things? And where this eventually fell on is the lawyers had to look back at it and ultimately determined that, yes, like, you do need to do this repetition element, reading from the city charter, before entering upon the duties of the office. 2, take and subscribe in a book to be kept by the city clerk for the purpose. And she did do that. She did, you know, sign the little contract. That's my words. This continues. The oath of allegiance and oath of office prescribed in the Constitution of this Commonwealth and an oath to support the Constitution of the United States. So you must do the oath of allegiance, and part of doing an oath, however we're going to interpret this, is apparently you must verbalize it back. You know, this ritual of, like, doing a public oath, it serves two purposes. One is it's for the people to see. The people heard you. You swore you would do this. But it's also for God to see. We really can't take out, like, that religious element. But once this blew up, Tanya then released a statement. And I'm going to read it to you. And I am very, very confident that she did speech to text for this. And you'll kind of see why colleges, like grammatically or like just the language she uses. It begins. So let me get this straight. You're okay with someone mindlessly mouthing an oath only to betray every promise they've ever made, but me internalizing my oath, committing a prayer between myself and God in honor of that very oath is a problem for you? Nobody loves and appreciates this country more than an immigrant. We've worked too hard to be here. We take nothing for granted, and seriously, you can't honestly believe a woman who fought for citizenship, ran for public office in the face of unrelenting racism, Islamophobia, and sexism, just so she can serve her community, and who blessed and encouraged her child's enlistment into the armed services in defense of this country, doesn't love and cherish it. The coverage of this non-incident aren't serious commentary. They're one thing and one thing only, more anti-immigrant racist vitriol. And she is 100% correct with that. And I remember the same thing happened to Obama when he swore in, because I think he maybe stuttered or he like flipped two of the words like during the repetition. So they had to like go back and like do it again. And, you know, Fox News ran like a week of coverage of, look at how this man can't even do this right. It ranged from incompetent to disrespectful, if I remember their coverage correctly. And this is just, again, treating her as the ungrateful immigrant. And how do we want you to show your gratefulness? Well, one, it will never be enough for these people. But we want you to do the rituals. And for everyone who is taking this seriously, for them, the ritual is about obedience. It's not about respect. And afterwards, it looks like Tanya has deleted her Twitter account. Also, so did Michael Flaherty. And I will say, that's a very smart idea. If I was in public office, I probably also wouldn't have a Twitter account. It doesn't seem to gain you anything except headaches. So, like, there's no point of having it. Like, Frank Baker never had one when he ran. And if you took my little bet that I put out on Twitter, I said that the Herald will run somewhere between 5 to 6 stories on just this topic. And so far, they have done 4 as of this recording on Sunday. So we're getting very close to my guess. And as a book recommendation, if you would like to learn more, because I finished this a few months ago, so it's still kind of in the back of my mind, titled The Power of Ritual in Prehistory, Secret Societies and Origins of Social Complexity, you can kind of get a little bit more into what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the roles of rituals, specifically around political governance and our class hierarchies. But that's all I have to say for this. We have our new council sworn in. Later today, Michelle Wu will be giving the State of the City address. I don't know if they moved it because of the snowstorm. Actually, now that I voiced that out loud, I'll check. But I plan on doing the next episode covering that. And as a little preview, I have some great interviews lined up because I'll be on vacation during my normal times of recording. But I am very much committed to keeping to the once-a-week schedule. And the reason I have that strong commitment is because of my lovely Patreon subscribers, who I feel a sense of obedience towards, because you have enough faith in me, or you trust me, or you enjoy this at the entertainment level, or you just like that I piss people off. Whatever your motivation, I appreciate you and your financial contribution. And if you were listening to this and to start off the new year, you also would like to make a contribution, not just for the podcast and the TikTok things that I do, but just more in general independent news media. You can do it as an FU to the Herald. You can cancel your subscription from them. Give me the same amount. I ask for substantially less. And I'll still give you all the news you need to know. Win-win. Everyone wins. Except for the Herald, because we do not live in a zero-sum game. Anyway, thank you to those people who do subscribe. If you would like to subscribe, and if you don't have the financial resources, I totally understand. You can always like, retweet, quote, share it around. I might be featured in the Boston Globe article soon, and they might actually refer to me as the Bostopian news guy. We'll see. And you can always find my work at patreon.com/bostopiannews. And currently, there is not a single thing paywalled. Though asterisk, I always reserve the right to do so. And with that, take care, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.